Welcome back to Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. 31 people were killed in the Belgian capital of Brussels earlier this week by two suicide bombers linked to the Islamic State, or ISIS, brothers named Ibrahim and Khaled El Barakoui. Brussels, which is home to the headquarters of the European Union, has been in mourning over what is being called the worst attack in its recent history. European authorities think the incident is related to the November 2015 attacks that took place in Paris. In fact, a man named Salah Abdeslam, who was arrested in the Brussels suburb of Molenbeek just last week, might be connected with the Paris killings. Abdeslam is to be extradited to France and claims no knowledge of the Brussels incident. My guest is Jean Bricmont. He is a mathematical and statistical physicist at the University of Louvain and author of Humanitarian Imperialism, Using Human Rights to Sell War. He's based in Brussels, but now joins us from Paris. Welcome to the show, Jean.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, there's much talk about whether the Brussels and the Paris attacks were linked. As far as you can tell, were they? And is that even the most important question?
Well, I don't think it's the most important question, and I leave it to the police to decide that, but to find out. But of course, I suppose they are linked, yes. I mean, it's clear that all these attacks are linked to the situation in the Middle East, to our permanent war situation and so on and so forth.
And so how do you explain, you know, to those people particularly who lose loved ones in places like Belgium and France, etc., the simplistic reasoning that we hear from politicians is that these people hate us. But of course, it's much deeper than that.
Well, yes, I think there are two aspects. Well, first of all, I wouldn't want to have to explain it to the people who lost, relatives, but I can try to explain it to you. It's easier psychologically. But you see, the problem is that, well, suddenly they hate us, okay? But there are several factors. One is that they hate us in the main for good reasons. There are lots of reasons why, you know, they have lots of reason to hate us. The support for Israel is one of them. Israel is hated beyond belief in the Middle East. The war in Iraq, the repression, everything. The bombings now, everything. That's one thing. But one should not say, okay, they hate us, so they react like that, because there is also the religious aspect. Because, for example, the Vietnamese have been bombed for years in an atrocious way by the United States. You know that. They have never carried any terror attack in the United States. The Latin Americans, the Nicaraguans, the Cubans, the Venezuelans, the Chileans, and so on, they have been repressed also by the United States. They have never done any terror attacks against civilians in the United States. You also speak of discrimination, racism, and so on. What about the black community in the United States, Afro-American, if you wish? I mean, aren't they discriminated? Isn't there police violence? And where is their terrorism? There is no terrorism. So one cannot have a simplistic explanation. I mean, the one simplistic explanation and say, oh, look, these guys are religious fanatics. They hate us for our freedom. That's silly. They hate us for political reason. But the point to emphasize is that it's also religious, because there wasn't a religious factor, they would fight in other ways. And in fact, I should stress that there are lots of people in the Middle East and in North Africa and so on who don't like the West either. Nobody likes us, really. I mean, nobody. But the point is that they struggle within their own society, within their own country. They want to be left in peace. They want to try to solve their own problem, but they are not launching terror attack against civilians in the West.
Well, would you argue that the Islamic State uses suicide attacks and these kinds of targeted attacks where they, you know, kill dozens of people here and there as a very strategic tool, because they know how much attention, of course, the West pays to it. They know that that's how they can have the biggest impact. So it's a sort of a tool. And of course, they use religion and religious fanaticism to convince these recruits that that killing themselves in the name of Allah is a way to have a big impact.
Well, first of all, you must realize that most of the terror attacks are in the Middle East. They are against Syrians, they are against Iraqis, and so on. They've been against Algerians for many, many years. I mean, Algeria has had 10 years of terror like that. And there has been very little support from us to fight this terrorism. In fact, you see, the West has been using the terrorists against the secular regime that they didn't like they used the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union, and then they use them now against the Syrian state. And you see, there's something absolutely insane in our policies, because in the name of supporting, you know, this democratic uprising, we're actually supporting terrorists against states that we don't like, and we don't want to collaborate with states or movements like Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Russia, and so on, who are actually fighting terrorism, and for ideological reasons, we won't join them. So we are bombing ISIS, but, you know, with very little efficiency, and the question is, you know, why don't we either do nothing or go along with those who fight on the ground? The reason we don't go along with those who fight in the ground, I'm afraid, is because our ideological blinders prevent us from doing so. And in particular, of course, the pro-Israel forces in the West don't want us to have anything to do with Hezbollah, Iran, and so on. And that's, of course, the equation in which we are. And it's a completely desperate situation, because as the Paris attack and Brussels attack have shown, the mere use of police methods to control or to prevent these attacks has failed. I mean, obviously, the police has not been able to handle the situation, and our police is not trained to handle these, you know, terror network. So maybe they learn someday, but it's not so easy to control. So we are in a very bad situation, but I think it's related to the inconsistencies of our policy. It's you see, the point is that we make ourselves hated. That's not the problem. But there are still different kind of reaction to hate it. There are people who do it politically in their own countries, and then there are people who send suicide bombing everywhere. I mean, this is the difference, and we don't make that difference, and we even use sometimes the terrorists against the states we don't like.
And I'm so glad you brought up the fact that the main victims of ISIS are Muslims. In Turkey, there has been a wave of attacks linked to ISIS. January 10th in Istanbul, February 17th in Ankara, March 13th again in Ankara, March 19th in Istanbul. In fact, Turkish President Recep Erdogan said this week that his government identified one of the Brussels bombers, Ibrahim el-Barakoui, as linked to ISIS last June. And I'm wondering, wouldn't Europe, if it really worried about solving these issues and trying to address ISIS attacks, shouldn't it be coordinating with the governments of those countries in the Middle East that are also being targeted by ISIS?
Yeah, but you see, there is a difference between Turkey and Syria. Turkey has actually been helping the terrorists in Syria. Now, maybe it backfires in Turkey. Because you see, with those terrorists, those people are fanatics. So whatever you do for them, it's never going to be enough. After all, you know, look at your ambassador, I guess it's Cat Stevens, who was killed in Benghazi. I mean, the Americans did put those people in power in Libya, and nevertheless, they kill one of your, I forget if it's an ambassador or somebody, but one from your diplomatic corps. And you know why? Because probably wasn't doing exactly what they wanted him to do. That's of course the problem when you deal with fanatics. The Turkish may have problems like that too, but there was a problem with Kurdistan, Kurdish people, etc. It's a complicated mess, but of course, I mean, for example, there is at least one high-ranking member of the security forces in France who said that the Syrian government was willing to give to the French government before the November attacks, long before, the list of French jihadists or terrorists in Syria. And the French government refused, because the condition that the Syrian demanded is that they reopen their embassy in Damascus, which they refused to do, the French refused to do. So because of that, they didn't get this list. And of course, there were, of course, also these terrorists. And I think the Belgians now, the Belgian government's a big crisis. Some minister resigned or tried to resign just because, of course, they overlooked this information given to them by the Turks. Yeah. I mean, but you see, they are not, okay, I think, their policy is completely inefficient at the level of the police. But the basic problem for me is their irresponsibility in acting in the Middle East, not just in their war, which is one problem, but also in their support for people who don't like us, as if they liked us because they attack governments that we don't like.
You know, I also want to ask you what you make of the disproportionate media coverage whenever, you know, when we've seen the attacks in Brussels and Paris, you know, the whole world has mourned. But just a few days before the Brussels attack, there was a horrific shooting at a beach resort on the Ivory Coast where a gunman suspected to be linked to Al-Qaeda shot 19 people. And it got some attention, but not nearly as much as a Brussels or Paris attack. There have been ongoing attacks in Iraq, in Afghanistan, suicide attacks, bombings linked to the Islamic State, others linked to Al-Qaeda, and also just linked in general to the violence that the United States and Europe has fomented through its policies. Does disproportionate media coverage also kind of feed into some of our mistaken notions of why these problems are happening?
Sure, but of course, there is a human aspect to it. You see, obviously, I got lots of friends asking me if I was okay. I was not in Belgium, actually. I mean, there's a human aspect that you worry about people close to you more than you worry about strangers. That's something which I wouldn't blame the media for, because, you know, but of course, the problem is that most of the media are Western, and therefore the Westerners worry about them more than they worry about the non-Western people. That's, of course, a serious problem, and that probably increases the hatred and the hostility towards us in the rest of the world. But you see, the problem is that we should stop absolutely intervening in the internal affairs of other states, and we should cooperate with those states, and also cooperate with them when they want to help us. For example, the Syrian state, the Iranians, the Hezbollahs, express sympathies for the killings in Belgium, okay? And we don't treat them correctly at all. We consider them as enemies, and they are not our enemies. We should try to have a realistic policy. We should also, like the Russians have said, we should stop playing geopolitical games when it comes to the fight against terrorism. The terrorists are our enemies. I mean, I can understand the origins of the terrorism, that I agree. But Belgium was not involved in the 2003 war and didn't do all that much in the fight against terrorism. In fact, they also said they wanted to overthrow Assad, etc., so help the terrorists in Syria. So it seems to me that we have to have go back to a realistic policy rather than a so-called moral policy, which has nothing moral at all. For example, we have this human rights policy, but in fact we support Saudi Arabia, which commits horrible crimes in Bahrain, in Yemen, etc. And nobody does anything to that. You probably heard that the heir to the throne in Saudi Arabia was given the highest distinction in France, the Legion d'Honneur.
Right.
We gave the highest distinction that we could to the Turkish president.
And Israel. I mean, Israel, the policy with Israel is very hypocritical.
Israel, that's the elephant in the room that nobody discusses. Nobody. I mean, if you discuss Israel, then you're anti-Semitic. So nobody dares discuss that. It's sort of surprising. I mean, I see all these people. I mean, even Saudi Arabia. You see, you can lambast Saudi Arabia. You can say, oh, they behead people, they're horrible, etc. You can say that. But criticizing Israel, then that's, of course, a danger for your career, your political career, if you have a political career. If you criticize too much, of course, you can say, well, they should, you know, we should be for the two-state solution. They should not be so. They should do something. But if you say, okay, let's boycott or something, let's do BDS or something. Then, of course, if you do that, then you're out of the game. And that's, of course, a major problem. That's another major problem. We can't even discuss rationally what would be a good foreign policy from our point of view. That's absolutely catastrophic.
I'm wondering, John, if you can explain just for our audiences here in the United States whether the kinds of complex conversations of the kind we're having now that need to happen around the foreign policy, Western policy in the Middle East, and the blowback then on Western soil. If those conversations are happening in places like Paris and Brussels, where you are people talking in those terms, or are they so sort of shell-shocked by the attacks that that you don't get the dialogue that is necessary?
Well, it depends what you mean by discussions, you see. Well, of course, when I discuss with my friend, I say what I think. But if you speak of the mainstream media, I mean, okay, there are people who say, okay, they attack us for our values. That's not the only line. There are also people who say, well, they've been discriminated, look at the poverty, etc. As I said, the black community in the United States shows that this is not a valid explanation. But, I mean, by itself, I mean, without taking into account other factors. But you know, the media, I mean, they will, you know, they will focus on the cultural factors also. I mean, the origins of the people in the you know, the North African community, etc., and their culture and so on and so forth. But they are not going to, of course, question very much the effect of our policies, and they are not going to discuss also what a realistic foreign policy could be. You see, the problem is that I wrote this book about human rights, but it's a complicated thing. You must realize that the left has been even more taken by the human rights policy, even the far left, than the right. Traditionally, the right would have been more in favor of a realistic foreign policy. I maintain that this human rights policy is impossible to, you know, it's just impossible because the people who advocate them don't have the power to do these wars. The wars are always done by the United States or by the CIA or something like that, and they have no control over what they do. So in fact, they have killed, for example, any anti-war movement. There is no anti-war movement. There's not been any anti-war movement for decades in Western Europe, on the continent. There is in England, there is the Stop the War Coalition. I'm totally on the line of Stop the War Coalition because they're against war. I mean, they say no to war and no is no. I mean, you know, even if it's humanitarian. And that, I think, is the correct policy. But in France, for example, it would be impossible even to mention that. When there was the Libyan war, for example, the whole Belgian parliament voted for the war from the Greens to the far right, unanimously. And the far left was calling also for intervention. So, you know, we are 40 people demonstrating in front of the U.S. embassy during that war. So you must realize that there's been a total... That's a serious problem, I think, for the left. I don't know exactly in the United States. I think it's a little bit more discussed. But even, you know, I'm following very closely your presidential campaign, and even Bernie Sanders has been very weak, I think, on foreign policy issues. And in a sense, you could say Trump has been more radical in some of his, you know, declarations. I mean, although I don't trust him, but he's a clown in a sense. But nevertheless, he has said things about dissolving NATO, for example, and so on. And I think we have been much too much in this ideology where we are, in the end, the good guys because we are the human rights people, and the rest of the world are the bad guys, and we shouldn't talk to them. We should have no diplomacy. We should have no diplomacy with the Russians, for example. There is complete hysteria in our media, including on the left, against the Russians, against Putin, against he's demonized all the time. It makes no sense at all. We are not so pure and so holy, etc., and the others are not so monstrous that we have to do all this grandstanding. And the ideology of the human rights has been the way, if you wish, has been the Trojan horse that has destroyed the peace movement or the anti-war movement or any reflection about diplomacy or compromise or anything. We just decided that we have to defend democracy, which is us versus the rest of the world. And that's disastrous. I mean, for example, take Cuba. Now Obama has been to Cuba. But again, even in the left journals, I can assure you, I live here, I read everything. I mean, it's very difficult to say a good word about Cuba because it's a dictatorship. Okay. So, as you know very well, it's a complicated story. It's not
now,
such a dictatorship.
John, speaking of the issue of human rights, though, does the left in Europe connect the dots with their own human rights in their own countries? Because one could argue that the way in which Muslim communities, immigrant communities in some European countries are treated, particularly in France, also plays a role in the disaffection that young people feel and their vulnerability to radicalization. And does the left sort of see these impacts of racism within their own community, within Europe's own communities?
Yeah. I think they do. They usually do. I mean, it depends which part of the left you talk about, but part of the radical left certainly does criticize racism. But you see, that's only guilt-tripping the French. You see, the problem I have with that sort of argument is that then there is this hostility to the mainstream, to the white workers. You see, the white the native French, there is an enormous amount of hostility to them as being racist, which in some cases are. But you see, you don't build a political movement out of that, because nevertheless, all these marginalized communities are minorities. So I'm very much against what you call in the US identity politics, you see. I think it's a disaster because it has led, for example, you see that now in the election, in the primaries, in the Democratic Party. I mean, I think it's a fact that a lot of the Afro-American communities in the South have been voted for Clinton, which I think is a disaster for everybody, for the world, also for them. But I think large part because of identity politics, because some of, at least, you know, I've read Danforth, for example, from Black Agenda Report. I mean, you know, that lots of the leadership of the black community, including the churches, have been sold or bought by the Democratic Party leadership, and those people support Hillary Clinton. So the you know, this sort of herd behavior that identity politics has led to, or women having to be for Hillary Clinton, as Mrs. Albright said, that, you know, women have to help each other and so on. I mean, this sort of identity politics prevents from building a genuine progressive policy, which would be based on
I mean, to an extent, I agree with you, because certainly liberal politicians do benefit from a limited form of identity politics, and we do see those impacts here in the United States. Well, we've run out of time. I want to thank you so much, Jean, for joining us today. And we'll post a link to your Twitter account from our website, risingupwithsonali.com, later today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Jean Bricmon. He is a mathematical and statistical physicist at the University of Louvain and the author of Humanitarian Imperialism, Using Human Rights to Sell War. He is based in Brussels, but spoke with us from Paris. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar.